Please have your Bibles open at the passage we read a moment ago in Hebrews chapter 1. Hebrews chapter 1. So Christ is better, 10,000 times better than anything God had said or done in the past. He's not simply the best. He is altogether superior. Because he is utterly different. None can compare. And in the second and third verses of this chapter, the apostle outlines the areas of Christ's superiority. He is above all by his relationship with God the Father. He is God's Son. He is above all by his inheritance from God. He is the heir of all things. He is above all by his creating act with God. He was co-creator with the Father and the Spirit at the beginning of time. He is above all by his character as God. Notice that he is the exact character of the actual reality of God himself. And he is above all by his authority as God. He sustains all by his powerful word. So, by his relationship, his inheritance, his power, his character, and his authority, Christ is above and beyond all. But Paul has not finished. There is one more thing Paul has to say. And whilst we can't say it is the greatest part of his superiority, after all, nothing is greater than that he is the exact reality of the precise nature of God himself. Yet it must be the greatest fact about his activity, and it is essentially important to us. For without it, everything else about Christ, glorious though it may be, is of little value to us. Without this, Christ's sonship, his inheritance, his power, his character, his authority, incredible and magnificent as they are, will do us no good at all. In fact, the knowledge of those wonderful things about Christ will only convince us of our utter hopelessness because of our sinfulness. This final authority, this final superiority is found in the second half of verse 3. Can you find it there? I'll begin at the beginning of verse 3 and watch for it. He is the radiance of God's glory and the exact imprint of his nature, and he upholds the universe by the word of his power. After making purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high. After making purification for sins. Does that really matter? You mean he does that as well as all the other? No. He does that above all the other. Though I'm afraid millions don't recognize this fact, I want to say that this is the most generous and the hardest part of all Christ's superiority. And I say that for two reasons. It is the most generous because it is the one thing he did not have to do. All else was his by eternal right as the second person of the triune Godhead. His sonship, his inheritance, his power in creation, his character in absolute harmony with the Father, his authority, all of that was his. Without them he would not be what he was, equal with God. He didn't assume them, he didn't take them on. They were always from all eternity his by right. But the purifier of sinners, making sinners clean, That is different. He was God and always would have been, even if he had never done that. And I say, secondly, it was the hardest thing for him to do. It was not hard for him to create the universe or to sustain them by his constant watchful care, or to be a perfect reflection of his Father in heaven. After all, it's not hard for a son often to look like, speak like, and I'm afraid often act like his father. And Jesus did all that perfectly because he was with his Father forever. But to purify rebel sinners against God and make those who had no time for God and rebelled against God and whose lives were so utterly unlike God clean, pure, perfect to sit with him in heaven, that was different. And to do it in a way that God could be consistent with his utter holiness and justice, that was hard. Jesus could never cease to be what he is, but the cost was to come what he never was. He who was the exact reality of God became the exact reality of humanity and confined himself to a mother's womb and became our sin. The hardest part was for him who was utterly clean to be unbelievably dirty for our sin, counted as sin, separated from his Father, divorced from heaven. And all that for Christ, my dear friends, was unimaginably hard. I mean that. Unimaginably hard, because no religion has ever invented under heaven, ever imagined God would become sin and die so that sinners might become free from sin and live. That is uniquely Christian. But just for a moment, I want to look at this word purification. You see it there? We speak about a blot on a man's character, something that mars or spoils him. In a similar way, we talk about someone having a dirty mind or a foul mouth. The one great blot on human nature, yours and mine, however decent you are in Welling Garden City, the one great blot on human nature is its rebellion against its creator. Have you never rebelled against God? Have you never gone your way and not God's way? Have you never thought your thoughts and not God's thoughts? Have you never said your words and not God's words? You ever made anyone cry, ever hurt anyone? By your actions, your words? The Bible describes our lives as a spiritual and moral uncleanness, and the longer we live, the more the dirt spreads and the more ingrained it becomes. Let me illustrate that for you. Many years ago, my youngest son's car leaked onto my driveway. The blocks were too ingrained with oil to clean. And for a long time, I grumbled and pointed to the clean drive under my new vehicle. Then one day, my vehicle leaked oil. Oh, no, it wasn't as widespread on the other side of the drive where Andrew parked his car, but just as damaging. It was the start. Sin is like that, isn't it? It's tragically in our nature to be sinful, and with age and experience, sin spreads and ingrains. That is exactly why the hardest people to win for Christ are the elderly who have resisted him for 70 or more years. And their whole way of life is no longer listening. They are experienced, very experienced at resisting God. And religion is no answer to sin. I paid a small fortune for a liter of acid to remove the oil on the drive, but it wasn't any use. I had in the end to take them up, get rid of them, and put brand new blocks in place. Ours is a religious world. 98% of the world's population believe. But like acid on my drive, religion cannot remove the stain of sin. Let me give you a very serious illustration. Simon Wiesenthal published a book entitled The Sunflower. It recorded some of his time in German concentration camps. He was a Jew, and he described a wartime experience. One day, as Wiesenthal's prison section was cleaning out rubbish from the hospital for German casualties, a nurse approached him. "Are you a Jew?" she said. Then she signaled him to follow her. Apprehensive, Wiesenthal followed her into a dark room where a lone soldier lay, covered in bandages. White gauze covered the man's face, with openings cut for the mouth, his nose, and his ears. The nurse disappeared and closed the door quietly behind her. The wounded man was an SS officer. He'd summoned Wiesenthal for a confession. My name is Karl, he said, and I must tell you this horrible deed. I must tell you, because you are a Jew. Karl began his story about his Catholic upbringing, which he abandoned when he joined the Hitler Youth Corps. He later joined the SS, served with distinction, and returned severely wounded from the Russian front. He described as an act of revenge, his unit rounded up 300 Jews, herded them into a house, covered it with petrol, and fired grenades at it. All who tried to escape were shot. Karl continued, and I quote, "The screams from the house were horrible. I saw a man with a small child in his arms. His clothes were alight. By his side stood a woman, doubtless the mother of the child. With his free hand, the man covered the child's eyes. Then he jumped into the street. Seconds later, the mother followed. We shot. I'm left here with my guilt. In the last hours of my life, you are with me. I do not know who you are, but I only know that you are a Jew, and that is enough. I know what I've told you is terrible. In the long nights while I have been waiting for death, time and again I have longed to talk about it with a Jew and beg forgiveness from him. I know what I'm asking is almost too much for you, but without your answer, I cannot die in peace." Simon Wiesenthal stared out of the window at the sunlit courtyard. He looked at the eyeless heap of bandages lying in the bed. And he writes, "At last I made up my mind, and without a word, I left the room." Beyond those awful atrocities committed by the SS officer are two far greater tragedies. First, in a dying soldier's vain belief that just anyone can forgive sins on behalf of others. And second, that neither the German nor the Jew knew where forgiveness could be found. Do you? There was a man in the Old Testament who had a major blot on his character, and he longed to be clean. He longed for a clean conscience and a right relationship with God. He had good reason. He had committed murder and adultery. He had brought discredit to the nation, sinned against the woman, murdered her husband, and betrayed his own wife. Above all, he had broken the law of God and the Creator's trust in him. And he cried out, "Wash away my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin." That's David, as you know, in Psalm 51. He knew he couldn't do it himself. He knew no one else could. My friends, as we sit here this morning and I stand here before you, we all have hidden sins in our past, don't we? Skeletons in the cupboard of our mind and experience. We all know the sin that spoils, the thoughts that trickle into our mind and the longings that soak into our soul. Our sin has spoiled the world, all of us, our little world around us. And if we're honest, we admit it. And if we don't admit it, we're sinful, and that's sin. Now, the word purification right here in front of you literally means what it says, to make something clean. It's clearing away the filth. It's the ordinary word for cleaning a cup. The best religion can do is make things look better. You go to church, you practice Christianity, you look good, you sound good for a short hour or two. But are you clean, really clean? I mean, is your conscience clean? Is your heart clean? Is your mind clean? Are your actions clean? I mean, is your sin forgiven and removed from God as far as the heavens above the earth, as far as east is from the west? And do you know that? And here in Hebrews 1 verse 3, the answer to David's prayer and our need, Jesus Christ made purification for sins. And how did he do it? Well, I'll tell you. First, by himself. Most Greek manuscripts have a single word here that translated means by himself. It's not in your translation. Sadly, they've overlooked it. He came to our rescue alone. By himself. It was the story of his life, for no one fully understood who he was. In that sense, he was born alone, he lived alone, he died alone. Only once did he ask his disciples to pray with him, and they fell asleep. The angels heralded his birth, and then they left him. They aided him in the desert when he was tempted, and then they left him. They returned to him in the Garden of Gethsemane when he sweat great drops of blood in agony, and then they left him. And on Golgotha, I see legions of angels ready to come. But God said, the Father said, leave him alone. Even the Father turned his face away. He was alone by himself. Few understand really why Christ came and died, even today. But there was no other good enough to bear the price of sin. He alone. And secondly, not only by himself, but he did it by his life and his death. He was the one man on earth who never earned the reproach of God. No sin. His life was clean, totally. His conscience was clear, totally. There was not a blot against his character. He's the only person who ever walked planet earth who chose to die. No one else ever has, ever can. We all die. Someone may choose their time, their manner, but they don't choose to die. He had a clean record from conception to the grave, and he could challenge his critics. Can any of you prove me guilty of sin? And with all their clipboard information, they could find nothing to hang on him, except his claims that were true. Leaving heaven, he said, I will show how serious sin is. I will show the cost of healing the breach between God and the human race. I will show what sin deserves. I will do what men and women cannot do with all their religion. So when they came to a place called Golgotha, there they crucified him. And in that awful darkness, he carried our sin, our guilt, our punishment upon himself. He became what we are, so that the rebellion of sin could be forgiven, the stain of sin could be removed, the conscience of sin could be made clean. Now, you may not understand how all this could be, but it's enough that God accepts his Son as a substitute for you. Believe it, even when you do not understand it. He carried our sin in his body on the tree. He who knew no sin became sin for us. In the New Testament, the Apostle Paul made a massive statement, and it goes like this. It's in Romans 3 and verse 25. God sent his Son as a propitiation by his blood. Now, the ESV keeps that word propitiation in because, wisely, it cannot find any what we call synonym to replace it. There is no other word in the English language. When you find it, make sure you tell me. There is no other word in the English language that quite replaces all that propitiation mean. So most of them paraphrase it. They put it in a long sentence to try and explain it. It was well known in the first century, because in the first century, the task of us here was to do all we could to please the gods. The Olympic Games began by the idea of propitiating, putting the gods who were in a grumpy mood in a good mood. We would do it all by a whole show of games. That's how the Olympic Games started. And they would enjoy it and smile on us. Now, the word in the New Testament is the same word, and it means turning away the just anger of God against our sin. That's all. That's all. And God did it to demonstrate his justice, says Paul, at the present time. Can you pause on that a moment? What if God were to demonstrate his justice on my life right now? You would be terrified because you would be next. Now here is Christ, sinless. In the Garden of Gethsemane, he wrestles with the gathering darkness of clinging sin, but not his own. On the cross, he felt the full weight of God's justice, God's holy anger against him, but not his own. How else do you understand the scriptures? He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him and cause him to suffer. Oh, this is not liked by so many. But there is no other way. God said, I will show you my justice by showing you how I hate sin. But if I show it in you, you'll be utterly destroyed. So to spare the sinner, I will turn my anger against my Son. So that you will know that I do not wink at sin. I do not simply rub it out and say it doesn't matter. I do not turn my back upon it and pretend it never happened, as we all do constantly. God says, no, sin is what has ruined this world, and my little sin has contributed to it. And I'll show you how much I hate it. Look at the cross. Look at the cross. And the Son fled the scene, and Christ was left in darkness on Golgotha, and his cry, my God, why have you forsaken me, was real. In Christ, God had punished sin to its full extent in order to show his justice and forgive the sinner freely Freely. Yes, freely. He did it by himself. He did it by his life and his death. But one last thing. He did it by his ascension. Did you notice how Paul concluded verse 3? After he had provided purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the Father in heaven. The apostle even misses out the resurrection. That is understood. He can't get back there unless he rises from the dead. After he had made purification for sins, which included his real death on the cross and his time in the grave and his resurrection, he returned to where he began, in heaven. Now, the verse doesn't close before the scene has shifted from the cold, black confines of the cross and the grave to the splendor of heaven. Let me paint a picture for you in words. I want you for a moment in your mind, and if it helps, you can close your eyes. I'll still be here when you open them, I hope. I want you to see those unnumbered ranks of angels surrounding the throne of God. His, the Father's, is the majesty and glory at the heart of heaven. And a mighty chorus has been going on of worship and adoration to the sovereign of the universe. The glory of God, the honor of his name, the splendor of his majesty. Then, I imagine, a sudden silence falls in heaven. Someone has entered the throne room of majesty. And as he approaches, the angels fall back and give way. He advances boldly, confidently, to where no angel dares to tread. Look, his hands are pierced. His feet are pierced. A wound has lanced his side. His face is torn and bruised. He reminds us of a lamb slaughtered for sacrifice, and yet now he is gloriously broken, triumphantly wounded. He approaches the throne and sits down on the right hand of the majesty of God, and suddenly all heaven explodes in a mighty chorus. Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and glory and honor and praise. After he had provided purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty in heaven. All that he ever needed to do for you was done. And he's there now. For me. For you, if you trust him. And therefore he is able to save completely. Sometimes they used to say, from the guttermost to the uttermost, completely, those who come to God through him. And there he always lives to intercede for us. My friend, if you are a Christian this morning, there is your security. Never doubt it. Not on the cross, a crucifix is not our symbol, but Christ on the throne in heaven. His very presence is enough to guarantee all are accepted who trust him. The Father cannot, will not deny his Son. And all whom he gave to his Son before the world began will be there with him. Every Christian is part of this inheritance. In his final prayer, that beautiful prayer in John 17, when Jesus prayed for his disciples, he said, I have revealed you to those whom you gave me out of the world. They were yours. You gave them to me. Isn't that a beautiful thought? They were before the foundation of the world. They belonged to you and you gave them to me. I am praying for those you have given me, for they are yours. Father, I want those you have given me to be with me where I am. My friend, is that not sufficient for you? Oh, and before you say, but you just said that was for his disciples. Listen to how he goes on in John 17. I do not pray for these only, but for all who will believe in me. Given before the beginning of the world to me, so that I, with them, can sit with you in glory. That's how clean we can be. Do you wonder that the Apostle Paul says this purification is above all? Do you wonder that I said this was the greatest and yet the hardest part of all his activity? But is there someone here who still prefers to go it alone and leave Christ out of their life? Oh, my friend, fall before him now and go in your heart and thank him for all that he has done. Then go out and live for him after he had provided purification for sins. He sat down at the right hand of the Father. A moment of silent prayer. Have you something to say to God? Maybe it is simply, thank you, Lord, I knew all that, and it's mine. Or maybe, please, Lord, make it mine forever.